Okay, so this is bio 241, February 6th, Thursday. So end of our second week, and here is the sign-in sheet. This is your receipt that you're in class, so make sure you sign it, okay? And it's from the official roster. If you think you're in this class and you're not on this roster, then you have to see me because chances are you're not in the class. So here's a little excitement this morning. Make sure you're there on the sign-in sheet. We'll figure out why you're not there if you think you should be on that sign-in sheet. And that might be okay because I think we still can register students for class until maybe Saturday. So definitely check that out. Okay, I had one question on where do you find the practice quizzes that are online that you do not submit? I think that was the question. Was that the question that you had? Okay, and you know that it is in weekly assignments. So I'm working on the left-hand screen up over here, so we just click on weekly assignments. And of course, whenever you see a dollar sign that catches your eye, and you know that's for course points, that's not just a practice quiz. That's for real course points. But nonetheless, the practice quizzes are in here as well. All right, so let's open up the week one. And here's the first page, just the objectives and the chapter readings, the page numbers that you have to know. And then you would click to the second page. Here are some animations with some quiz questions underneath those. You don't submit them. That's just for practice, again, working with the concepts. But now here are the practice quizzes that I think you were asking about, right? And this page comes right before what? The online quiz that is mandatory. Not really mandatory, but if you don't take it, you get a zero. So, right, you really have to take that. It's hard to average zeros away. So these are the practice quizzes. And it's even from the 11th edition of your textbook and the 10th edition. Some of the questions will be the same. Some of them will be reworked in a little bit different ways, so you get to think about a concept from different angles. And so you get a lot of practice. Now, the questions that I'd like here, it looks like in this particular chapter, I like all of them. There's maybe 1 through 27. 27 is the last one. Maybe there's 30 questions. I'm not really sure. But nonetheless, all right, these are the questions I like. So you only should really look at the ones that I like. Because I might take a question from these practice quizzes and put it on the lecture exam. And that will get you familiar with what's happening in the chapter two. Right? Okay, now don't forget those study guides are real important because it will tell you exactly the same information. But it will also tell you exam figures. Figures that I could lift out of the textbook and put on the exam and then have you relabel them. And on a lecture exam, there will be a word bank there for you. It won't be like a practicum. Okay, so did I answer your question pretty well?
No.
Yeah? Oh, yeah, question. They don't always open. That's right. For instance, if you open up this one, and maybe I'll try in just a second. If you open up this one, then this site right here knows that you're working in the 11th edition. And then when you go down over here and click on the 10th edition, any of these right here, it's going to say, huh, you're in the 11th edition. Why do you want to come over here? So then just backtrack, go back to the previous window, and just click it again. And it might even come up with a question and says, do you really want to switch editions? And you say yes. All right, so I think you just have to do it twice. That's kind of a silly feature of using different editions. Oh, you have to speak a lot louder. Oh, no. Okay, let me try. So let me click on one of these things. All right, like, I think this will take you right. Let's do this one, multiple choice. You could right-click. Oh, and Blackboard doesn't like you to go outside of that environment anymore. But here is that link anyway, right? So you got to click. You got to make a couple clicks to get there. Okay, the system is having difficulty processing your request. All right, okay. Is that due to weather, maybe? That happens on the East Coast, too. Okay. There wasn't like a snowstorm. What about this? What about this one? Oh, well, that took us there. I don't know. Maybe I need to check that link. Because where we want it to go is right here, multiple choice quiz. All right, so... So I can get to it here. Maybe that link got broken. So you could click on multiple choice quiz, true, false, fill in the blank. I maybe have some of these on that previous slide. So if you get to a page that's a login page and it's asking you for a username and password, just ignore it and click on resources. Okay, just click, go to resources, and it will take you right here. You do not need a password. You don't need to log in. You don't need an account to work with these questions. All right, well, since we got to this website, let me try it again. Oh, no, we clicked on this one, not this one over here. You're switching to a different book. Yeah, okay, big deal. It's gonna lose information. I don't care, right? I just want at that information. So, oh, here, it looks for an email and password. Well, forget it. Just say resources. All right, now here for chapter one, here are those things that I have. It says there's something wrong with that link. Okay, so that's okay. That just happens sometimes. I don't know why. And that is the reason why I just don't have a statement and then a hidden hyperlink. That's why I have that link backed up as well. So if you're having trouble with these, go ahead and click on that. And if that doesn't work, go ahead, copy and paste it. All right. And if that doesn't work, then we're out of luck for some period of time. I'm not sure. Okay. All right. So here is the quiz, week number one. It's due February 14th. Is that right? Oh, 2:13. Uh-oh. Is that no longer available to you? I'm going to have to check on that availability. 22805. Ah, that's not your, this is, yeah, who knows? Who knows what's in it? Well, you all know what the problem is. And that's why you have to send me your CRN number. Okay, because I'll just get lost, like we just got lost. All right, so maybe let me try a course for this semester. Course for this semester probably looks like 22460. I think that's a good one. That's an active one. Okay, now weekly assignments. But what we talked about still holds. Still holds true. All right, weekly assignments. But let's double check, make sure that we have these things set up right. Okay, so syllabus quiz is still there, but remember, that's going to go away this week. And yeah, as a matter of fact, today, because today is Thursday. All right, and week number one is February 6th. That's due today. And don't forget, last week was kind of a short week, so I didn't want to have a weekly quiz at the end of last week, so I put 2 weeks this week. So you got to take 2 quizzes this week. So here's February 6th for chapter 2. All right, and we're going to be done with that today in lecture as well. Week 3, do I have that right? 13th, okay. So that is next week on Thursday. But don't forget, from here on out, every Thursday, 11 p.m., you have a quiz that's due, except for spring break. You don't have to do that. Okay, any other good questions about Blackboard? Sometimes it's a little bit cumbersome when we go off out of Blackboard, but it's not too bad. You can just persevere and click, and you can find your way around. All right, so on the right-hand slide, we have the schedule. Let's just make sure that we're all in the same schedule. We're going to finish up chemistry today if I stop talking. All right, we can get to that third part of it. And then we got a couple more lectures, and our first exam is going to be on a Tuesday, the 25th, not a Thursday. And I think I switch them around. You probably have a couple on a Tuesday and a couple of them on a Thursday. All right, so here's a Tuesday. What about the next one? Is that a Thursday and the next one? Yeah, it's a Thursday. The next one's a Thursday. And then the last one, of course, is on a Thursday as well. All right, so we flip that back around. The exam, 1, 2, 3, and 6. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and 6. That's what we're going to do. 1, 2, 3. Yep. All right. All right, so do you have, I'm going to put all this stuff away. Do you have any questions over what we've been talking about so far? Maybe as I get this started, yeah, we're going to go into nucleic acids, but maybe I'll start by asking you a question, and that is, what is the strange thing about pH? That when you first start to use it, first start to think about it, it seems really awkward. It seems really awkward until it just makes sense and you just talk about it properly. And that is, as a solution becomes more acid, okay, what about the hydrogen, what happens to the hydrogen ion concentration as it becomes more acid? Hydrogen ion concentration goes up, it increases, but what about the pH number? It goes the opposite way, all right? So don't be fooled with that. That's because there's an inverse relationship in order to get that log function working just fine. All right, so we looked at some building blocks of compounds. What's a building block of a polysaccharide? It's a building block of a polysaccharide. I tell you what, a polysaccharide, is that a sugar, a protein, lipid, or nucleic acid? It's a sugar, yeah. What's a building block? Okay. I wouldn't want to say amino acid necessarily for polysaccharide. I would like to say a monosaccharide is the basic building block of a polysaccharide. And a monosaccharide would be something like glucose or fructose, right? And those are both 6-carbon sugars, but a 5-carbon sugar is a monosaccharide as well. It just has a shorter carbon backbone. Okay. All right, so that's the backbone. That's the building block of a polysaccharide. What about a lipid? What are some building blocks of a lipid? Building blocks of a lipid. Okay. Well, I'm sure you've had these measured in your blood before. Like a triglyceride is a lipid. What's the building block of a triglyceride? Fatty acid, as a matter of fact. Tri is a good hint. 3 fatty acids. And also one other thing, the glycerol molecule, which kind of looks like a sugar, kind of looks like an alcohol as well. Some people call it a sugar alcohol. But it has those OH groups, right, that can participate with another OH group on a fatty acid. And actually, it's a carboxyl group on a fatty acid. And that fatty acid can be substituted for that OH group at those 3 locations on glycerol. So remember, glycerol has 3 carbons in it, and that's why it can bind 3 fatty acids. And then my favorite molecule is a phospholipid. What are the building blocks of a phospholipid? Okay, it's going to be 2 fatty acids, that same old glycerol, but instead of the 3rd fatty acid, you got some complicated phosphate molecule. Okay, and that's the level that you need to know, right? But what's really cool about that phosphate group? Makes it different from the rest of the molecule. It's polar, that's right. So that end of the molecule likes to be associated with water, but the fatty acids don't. Likes to be associated with the lipid world, oil world inside our bodies. Okay. And then, of course, we got done talking about amino acids and the building block for amino acids, right? We got done talking about proteins, and the building block of a protein is amino acid, and we learned about different kinds of structure, like primary structure, secondary structure, that stuff. All right, so the last group of important chemicals in our body are nucleic acids. All right, so we want to find out immediately what a building block of a nucleic acid is. Well, maybe I'll give you an example of a nucleic acid. The DNA that makes up a chromosome, that's a nucleic acid. We have different kinds of RNA in our body. Those are nucleic acids. All right, so what is the building block of these things? It's called a nucleotide. All right, and a nucleotide has this fundamental structure. It has a 5-carbon sugar, so that's not glucose. Right? It's a different kind of sugar, and it's a ribose sugar. And then off of one position over here, we got a phosphate group. So you say, oh, well, that makes this thing kind of water-soluble. But, oh, this sugar group over here makes this molecule water-soluble. Right? That's just some basic physical chemistry. And then on the opposite side of this sugar, we have something that's a base. All right, so it's not an acid, but it's a base, so we just say that it's a base. And there are 4 different kinds of bases that could be substituted in this location. All right, this ribose really doesn't change for DNA, but these bases do. And they're guanine, thymine, cytosine, and adenine. And probably that's the last time I'm going to say these names out loud, because we just say G, right, TCA for these compounds, and everybody will know what you're talking about. All right, so a nucleotide can be bonded to another nucleotide with a covalent bond with a chemical reaction you're familiar with already, which is, I don't have it on this slide, but you looked at 3 slides previously that describes that reaction. All right, so this is a polymer of a nucleotide, right? It's just a nucleotide polymer. How did we build polymers before? What kind of reaction? Okay, it has something to do with water. It's called a dehydration synthesis reaction, right? So when we put these two nucleotides together, we take a H from one and we take an OH from the other, that becomes a water, and now these two nucleotides are joined together, right? And that goes on and on and on and on. So these nucleic acids are very, very long in most cases, especially if it's DNA. Oh, how long is this DNA molecule? Well, we have 46 chromosomes in our body, okay, in a normal cell. If we take all those chromosomes out, not from just one cell, but from every cell, and string those molecules out together, that's 250,000 miles for a typical person, which is the distance from Earth to the Moon. So these things are, what, really, really long, and they contain a lot of information. All right, so let's look at this polymer a little bit. So I see that it is, what, a repeating pattern, repeating subunits, and this, sometimes you might want to call this a rail, and the rail is made out of this ribose and a phosphate group, right? Then another ribose and a phosphate, ribose-phosphate. That's a continuous line. And these bases are sticking out to the side. Right, so that's what I want you to see with this single strand of a nucleic acid. This is just one strand. But nucleic acids can form another strand over here, and then it's going to be double-stranded. All right, so because this thymine is relatively small, okay, we could then put in a larger base next to it and it will fit together very nicely. All right, but that double strand won't fit together with guanine and adenine because they're too big. They won't fit inside the molecule. So this DNA works really nice, right? It forms a double strand because of the structure of these nucleotides. And if we change the structure of these nucleotides, then we're going to change the DNA. This 5-carbon sugar, in particular in DNA, is deoxyribose, not just the usual kind of ribose, deoxyribose, and you can probably take a guess and tell me what that means. Deoxy, D means without. Yeah, it's missing an oxygen atom someplace in this whole big molecule here. It's a little bit different than a ribose sugar, it's missing an oxygen, right? But it still has these bases. And these bases pair up. You're going to have one big one and one small one when we make a double strand. Guanine always base pairs with adenine, cytosine with thymine. That's just a base pair rules. All right, so do I have an example? Here's a pretty good example. All right, so just pretend here is that backbone in a nucleic acid, and here's a base sticking out to the side. We see a large guanine molecule and a smaller cytosine over here. Right, so if when these things come together, there's enough room on the inside of that DNA molecule for these things to fit. But there's something else going on. Right? We have hydrogen bonds. We have three hydrogen bonds that form between guanine and cytosine, and there are only two between thymine and adenine. So in order for these things to fit together, they have to have not only just the right size, but they have to have the right shape and a number of hydrogen bonds in order for DNA molecule to become double-stranded. All right, so we got two strands of DNA, and sometimes we need to separate them, right? And sometimes we need to put them together. So if we have double-stranded DNA and we want to separate them, what kind of bonds do we have to break? These right here, which are hydrogen bonds. And what can you tell me about a hydrogen bond? Strong, intermediate, or weak? Or super, super weak? No, it's just weak. Right, so it's easy to separate complementary strands of DNA because the bonds that are holding them together are only hydrogen bonds. It doesn't take a lot of energy. Okay, so here is what DNA or a nucleic acid looks like. And I see GC and AT, and they're all in just different positions. All right, and so knowing the correct sequence of nucleotides in this DNA molecule is what we call the primary sequence of nucleotides in this DNA molecule. And that relates to what? The primary sequence of nucleotides in a protein. All right, so you see it's kind of a spiral staircase right here. But what I really want you to see, let's unwind the spiral staircase, and I see one strand on the left, one strand on the right, and we see on the right and left-hand side, I see sugar phosphate, sugar phosphate, sugar phosphate. That's the backbone on the both the right and left-hand side. And the bases then are poking to the interior of this molecule. So when you look at this flattened out representation of DNA, it kind of looks like a ladder. Right? Here's a handrail, here's a handrail on the other side, and the bases form what in a ladder, if we're going to use an analogy? The steps, yeah. They're forming the steps. So the handrails are sugar phosphate, and that's what actually makes this polymer. Okay. And G and C always base pair together. We call that the law of complementary base pairing. That's how it always happens in DNA. So if you see a nucleic acid, okay, you're just going to see these combinations all the time. Okay, there's another kind of nucleic acid that's important in your body, and that's called RNA. RNA is made from a ribose sugar, not deoxyribose like DNA. So here is the difference between a DNA nucleotide and a ribonucleotide, an RNA nucleotide. All right, so for deoxy, we said we're missing an oxygen atom. It's at this location in that ribose sugar. And here is the oxygen reappearing. So here is the ribose sugar. Here is the deoxyribose sugar. And so we are changing the structure of this ribose. And when we change the structure of it, what are we doing? We're changing the function of it, right? We're converting it from DNA to RNA. That's actually a pretty substantial change, only with what? A very small substitution of this one atom right here. Okay, so that's one difference between RNA and DNA. DNA's got the deoxy, RNA's got the ribose sugar. But there's another thing that's different too. In RNA, we never have thymine. We have uracil instead. Okay, so what base pairs with thymine in a DNA molecule? Adenine. And guess what's going to base pair with uracil? Adenine. It's going to be the same base pair. You're never going to see a thymine in an RNA molecule, which is a nice easy way to find out when you just look at something carefully, very quickly, even without care, what's RNA and DNA. So if we go back to this slide over here without hardly looking, do we know this is RNA or DNA? DNA because of the thymine, right? Thymine, that's easy to see. Another thing that you might notice that and recognize this to be DNA, because DNA is double-stranded, RNA usually is not double-stranded. So by the overall shape of these complementary molecules, you can tell if it's RNA or DNA. All right, so there are different kinds of RNA. Basically, we're going to start with three kinds, and RNA is used to make a protein. And so cells need RNA to join amino acids together to make a protein, and a cell needs a workbench of where that happens. The workbench where cells put together amino acids to make a protein is called ribosomal RNA. Ribosomal RNA comes together to make a ribosome, and a job of a ribosome is protein synthesis, especially one part of protein synthesis. Okay. Well, a ribosome needs amino acids in order to make a protein, right? That's the building block. And it can't go out and get amino acids by itself. There has to be another kind of RNA that will, and that's called transfer RNA. Transfer RNA is floating around inside the cell someplace, and an amino acid will bind to a transfer RNA, and then it will move over to a ribosome, give up that amino acid to this part of a ribosome, and it's going to then continue to make a protein. So you could think of transfer RNA as being something like a taxi RNA, right? Taxi or transfer. Don't ever repeat that in professional company, taxi RNA, okay? Or you could say it, but say you learned it over at Fullerton College. That would be fine, okay? Okay. All right, so you got the workbench. You've got something bringing in amino acids to make a protein. But you still have to know how to put the amino acids together. You have to know what the primary sequence of that amino acid is, and that is contained in the messenger RNA. So this messenger RNA is acting like the dictionary in how to spell a word properly. Right, so, and it's the primary sequence of nucleotides both DNA and RNA that determines the primary structure of that protein. That's something that we're going to look at, and we're going to see that there's a special genetic code that allows that to happen. Let's see if this works. It doesn't work very well. Okay. All right, so you just got to look at one slide over here. All right, so just remember what some of these RNAs are. We're going to use them, and then you're going to become familiar with them. That's it for this chapter? You guys have any more slides? No. Okay. Well, eventually today we're going to move on to the next chapter in just a second. But I really want you guys to know something about these different chemicals. And so even in Blackboard, I have this for you to look at. All right, so let's practice some of these things. I want you to observe these molecules, and you should tell me something about them and what they look like. All right, so what we have here is a rest station. And I made a video of this in Blackboard for you. I'm not going to show the video now because I want to do it manually. So I'm going to show you something. Okay, so what is this thing? Is this thing an amino acid? Is it a lipid? Or what the heck is this? And this is nice because we just talked about it, right? So I see a phosphate group, I see a ribose, and then I see a base over here. This is a nucleotide. But it could be a nucleotide of two different varieties. It could be a deoxyribonucleotide, or it could be a ribonucleotide. And here's kind of cheating because this thing is highlighted, and you see what right there? You see an oxygen, so this can't be deoxy. This is just a standard ribose sugar. So this is ribonucleotide, right? This is a ribonucleotide. This is going to go to make up DNA or RNA? RNA, yeah. So here's a building block of RNA. All right, restation. Okay, what kind of functional group is this here? Sulfhydryl group. Yeah, sulfhydryl. Is this a polar or nonpolar bond? Polar, right? Polar. So this thing is going to make amino acids, for instance, more soluble in water. Another group. What is that? It's an amino group. And here we have a carboxyl group. And you should probably know something about this carboxyl group because it has another important property in that it can donate this hydrogen ion to the solution that it's in. What do we call something that can donate protons to a solution? An acid, right? So this carboxyl group is an acidic group on this hydrocarbon chain, which also means that this end of the molecule is very reactive. It can participate in a lot of chemical reactions. And what do we got here? A phosphate group, right? And just like on that carboxyl group, this proton can come off, this proton can come off. So this is an acid group as well. And that makes this end of the molecule very polar because phosphorus was one of those polar elements that you had to know. And it's very acid, which makes it reactive. And as a matter of fact, we saw phosphate groups in the last couple of slides when we looked at nucleic acid. What were the handrails made out of? See, you had the sugar, ribose, or deoxyribose, and then the bridge to the next ribose was a phosphate group, right? And that phosphate group looks something like that. So we say phosphate, but you should really be aware that it's one phosphorus and then how many oxygens? Four. This kind of thing, when we write it on the board or in other kinds of nomenclature, we write it down as P little I, inorganic phosphate. Maybe I have a marker here. All right, so a lot of times we're just going to say P, and then an I. P is for phosphorus. This I stands for inorganic phosphate, which is everything else around the phosphate, these four oxygens and these hydrogens right here. Okay, so that phosphorus that you saw in DNA is an inorganic phosphate. That's really PI. Okay. Another rest station. What do you see right here? Well, I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I see six carbons forming a backbone. I see a lot of hydroxyl groups off of this. All right. This is a sugar molecule, right? And you don't even have to know what kind it is, but I want you to know this is a monosaccharide. What can you do with a monosaccharide with your level of knowledge right now? What can you do with a monosaccharide? You can make a disaccharide, or you can make a polysaccharide, right? All right, and this, if you ever see something like this, you should see that as a monosaccharide as well. When we looked at nucleotides or nucleic acids in the last chapter, you didn't see a six-figure ring. You saw, a five-carbon sugar. So monosaccharides can have a little bit different shape depending if there's six carbons or five carbons in the backbone. This one is six. So here's an example of a monosaccharide. Don't have to know which one. Oh, here we have another sugar molecule. Do we? No, we do not. Okay, because I don't see any hydroxyl groups here. It's just a really long hydrocarbon chain, right? Carbon and hydrogen, hydrocarbon chain. There's nothing polar on this end of the molecule. So you know this to be hydrophobic. This is a lipid. And in particular, what kind of lipid is it? Well, you see, oh, well, I see an acid over here, right? This carboxyl group is an acidic group. And here's the fatty end, here's the acid end, so this is a fatty acid. But you should probably know something a little bit more about this fatty acid, and that is, do you see any double bonds between these carbons? No, it's just a single bond, right? So this is what we call a saturated fatty acid, because at every carbon, there are two hydrogens. If there was a double bond here, this carbon would only have one, and this one over here would only have one. And what would we call that if there's double bonds in there? That's an unsaturated fatty acid, so keep your eye open for that. Here's a really good slide. What's happening here? I see a lot of carbons and a lot of hydrogens and stuff. Okay, let me throw you a curveball. Is this an organic compound? The one right here where I have the cursor. Yeah, why would you say that? Because it has carbon and it has a hydrogen atom covalently bonded to it. That's really the definition of an organic compound. All right, but and so here's an organic compound, but what kind is it? Is it sugar, protein, lipid, nucleic acid? Yeah, this is just an abbreviated form of that fatty acid that we looked at the previous slide. And then over here, what do we have? Glycerol. Make sure you can draw that out, right, so that you can recognize it very quickly. Right, draw it out maybe five times, and you'll memorize exactly what it is. So here it has three hydroxyl groups, can participate with these protons and the carboxyl of fatty acids. And then you can end up with something that looks like that. Three fatty acids on glycerol, and you know that to be a triglyceride, right? So that just follows from what the building blocks are over here. Now, how does your body make a triglyceride? What kind of reaction is being used? Dehydration synthesis, or sometimes they call that a condensation reaction. So not only is the triglyceride made, but also, in this case, three waters as well. All right, so that's how you make a triglyceride. Can you break a triglyceride down into its building blocks? Yes, you can. So this really should be a double arrow right here. Should have two arrows. But the reaction is not going to be a condensation if it's going to the left. It's not going to be a dehydration synthesis. It's going to be a hydrolysis reaction, right? So when water is used to break these bonds over here because you need some hydroxyl and protons to get back to these fatty acids and glycerol, we call that a hydrolysis reaction. So dehydration synthesis is making a big molecule out of small ones. Hydrolysis is making a bunch of small molecules out of a big one, right? And that's two forms of metabolism. We're going to talk about those in a little bit. Okay, what does this look like? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Forms this ring right here. That is another example of a monosaccharide. Right, so here's a monosaccharide. Don't have to tell me which one. You might know. And what do we got here? Yeah, it's a micelle. So what is this molecule? Phospholipid right here. Those two fatty acids on a glycerol. Here's that phosphatidyl group that has that nitrogen and a phosphorus on it makes it very polar, so that attracts water. The lipid part of a fatty acid doesn't want to have anything to do with water, but it's very happy when it groups together with other molecules, right, other phospholipids. So we like to call this thing a hydration shell. So if water can form different shells around either ions or polar compounds, then we call this a hydration shell. And you can see this sort of looks like a membrane, and it also sort of looks like a cell. Right? And these things just automatically form. Okay, what do we got here? Oh, sugar molecule. No, it is not. It is a steroid, right? And a steroid is which kind? Is it a nucleic acid, a protein, sugar, or what? It's a lipid. Yeah, so this is a lipid. And because I mostly see, just hydrocarbons in here. Right, these are all nonpolar groups. Maybe over here we see a little polarity, but not very much. Right, so indeed this is a lipid. Here is cholesterol. You don't have to know that, but cholesterol is a basic building block for important hormones in your body. Maybe you can remember. One was testosterone, one's cortisol. Another example would be estradiol, estrogen. All right, so that's important for all of those things. Okay, now here we talked about this guy already. Carboxyl group, fatty group, fatty acid. But what kind of fatty acid is that? Unsaturated fatty acid. What is this here? It's a building block for something. Yeah, that's an amino acid, and it's a building block for protein. Right? We can join these things together via peptide bonds. And if we were going to form a peptide bond between two amino acids, what kind of chemical reaction would be used? Dehydration synthesis reaction, right? Or condensation, right? Same thing as for what we looked at for sugars. All right, so be familiar with what this thing looks like. Remember, that's probably my favorite molecule. And here it is over here in a fancy illustration form. But here is 1, 2, 3. This is the glycerol background. Here are two fatty acids at these two positions. And at the third position, we have that phosphorus group, right? And we have this negative charge, which means it likes to dissolve in water. Here we have a positive charge on that nitrogen. And so that confers a lot of polarity to this molecule. So this is the hydrophilic end. This is the hydrophobic end. So here's a molecule that has those two natures, which is really important. Right? So be able to recognize this as a phospholipid. This is really easy to see, but maybe you have to pay attention to this shape just a little bit. Okay. And then we have some important signaling compounds. This might remind you of a molecule we've seen already, just in a little bit different form. I see an acid group here, and then I see this big long hydrocarbon chain. That's the fatty part. So this really is a fatty acid that has changed shape. It's been bent back on itself. These are what we call prostaglandins. And they are much different than fatty acids in our body. They are used to signal different parts of your body. So they're important for control. They sort of act like hormones. Some of them are hormones. And what do we have here? Besides just a really pretty picture you would like to hang on your wall. Okay, so I see an alpha helix, right? But really what I want you to see right here, which I want you to see the structure of this thing. How would you talk about the overall structure? These are all amino acids. Yeah, this is secondary structure, right? So secondary structure of a protein. And what's the building block of this? Yeah, so the building block of this is primary structure. If you say this is secondary structure, say the building block is primary structure. And you know that the primary structure is determined by the sequence of amino acids in the protein. All right, so secondary structure. Ooh, what do we got here? What can your body make with this thing? It can make DNA, right? It can be joined together with other nucleotides to make DNA. And here's that inorganic phosphate. Here is a what? Deoxyribose. And here's a base. And deoxyribose is used to make deoxyribonucleic acids. When we hardly ever say that. We say what? DNA. So deoxyribonucleotide makes DNA, building block for DNA. Just a small change right here makes all the difference in the world between DNA and RNA. Oh, what's this? That's an easy one. That's a hydroxyl group, right? And if you have a bunch of hydroxyl groups, what kind of bond is this right here? Polar or nonpolar? That's polar. So here you have the hydrocarbon backbone, that's nonpolar, but if you have put all these substituted hydroxyl groups on that backbone, then it turns into sugar. And you know sugar is very soluble in water. Why? Because of all these polar covalent bonds that run up and down the length of the molecule. Here, got to know this one. Glycerol, how many carbons? 3, that's easy to remember. How many hydrogens? Yeah, kind of easy to remember, right? 1, 2, 3. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, how many oxygens? Oh, that's even easier to remember. There's 3 oxygens. Right? So maybe draw this thing out a couple times. And it's a building block for something. Triglyceride. What do we got here? Carbonyl group. And are we at the beginning already? Maybe. Well, so what is this? It's a nucleotide. What kind? It's a ribonucleotide, because I see oxygen here. It cannot be deoxyribonucleotide. It's just a regular old ribose sugar, so that's a ribonucleotide. So let's see. Yeah, we've seen these before. So we could probably go a little faster. I don't really need to talk about these in so much detail. This is a sulfhydryl group. All right, you guys sound pretty tentative. What's here? Amino group. And here is carboxyl group. Phosphate group. If you want to say inorganic phosphate, that's fine with me. Here is a monosaccharide. Here is a saturated fatty acid, and indeed it is a fatty acid. Here we got a triglyceride synthesis with what kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis, right? And when you make a triglyceride, the building blocks are three fatty acids and glycerol. Another monosaccharide. Here we have a micelle, and you should kind of know what the building blocks of a micelle are, and that is the phospholipid molecule, and that's the basic building block of a membrane as well that we have all over our bodies. Oh, what was that? That was a steroid, right? Okay, and the top one is cholesterol. So cholesterol, steroids, any of those answers would be good. Whoa, what was that? I must have had too much coffee. Okay, that is a fatty acid, but a special kind. That's a unsaturated fatty acid. Here we got amino acid. And here is a phospholipid. Prostaglandin, a modified fatty acid. This is secondary structure. And here is a deoxyribonucleotide, right? And a nucleotide is a building block for making a nucleic acid. It's just one of the building blocks. Hydroxyl group. All right, ready for another one? Let's see what it is. Glycerol. Carbonyl. Ribonucleotide, because it had the oxygen there. Did I go too fast? Sulfhydryl group. Amino group. Okay, now the video that I have, I go kind of slow the first time, but I repeat it the second time really fast. All right, so the second time, let's go through it the first time. Okay, what's that? Carboxyl group. The second time through on the video, it's going to look like that. Okay, so just pay attention. But the nice thing about that is that you can look over all these molecules in practice in maybe less than a minute. All right, so that's one nice thing about having something fast like that. All right, so what is this thing here? Phosphate group. Monosaccharide. Saturated fatty acid. Triglyceride synthesis. Monosaccharide. Micelle. Steroid. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino acid. Oh, you guys are doing good. You couldn't do that before taking this class. You had no idea that would be an amino acid there. You've heard of them, though, I'm sure. What's that? Phospholipid. Prostaglandin. Secondary structure. Ooh, that was quick, but I think I saw it. Deoxyribonucleotide. Deoxyribonucleotide. Hydroxyl group. Okay, the other nice thing about the video, of course, is that you can pause it and you can go back, so you have random access to what all these things look like. All right, so please use that exercise to become familiar with all these different shapes of compounds and be sure to be able to characterize them as being either belonging to sugars or proteins or lipids or nucleic acids. Know the building blocks. Okay. All right, so anybody come prepared to ask me questions? You got any questions that we didn't answer so far? We're pretty good. All right, so we did chapters 1 and 2. What is next? I think we go out of order a little bit. Yeah, we go to 6. Interaction between cells and the extracellular environment. Yeah, question. The building block of a lipid?
Yeah.
Is that what you asked? Building block of a lipid? Building block of a lipid could be different things. Could be phospholipid. So I would probably be very specific if I'm going to ask you what's the building block of a triglyceride, because that's going to be different than a building block of a phospholipid.
Okay.
Both are lipids, but they have different structure.
So you'd be more specific.
I would be specific about that. Yeah. I wouldn't ask you what's a building block of cholesterol. We don't know what that is. But we know that cholesterol is a precursor to steroid hormones. Okay? Yeah. All right, what do I know about this right here?
No, maybe I would ask you what's the precursor to testosterone or estrogen, and you know that to be cholesterol. Okay, but if you really want to know if a question is going to be on the lecture exam or how close a question might be on a lecture exam, the answer is your study guide. Okay, so that will give you the best answer possible.
Just be familiar with that study guide. Okay, I think we're passing around the sign-in sheet, or did I forget to pass it around? Is it going around? Good. I didn't hear any screams, so I guess everybody found their name so far on that list. That's good. All right, so let's go on with the next chapter. We're going to talk about interactions between cells via the extracellular environment, we've got to define what that extracellular environment is. And then we're going to talk really about some more physical chemistry. How do things move across a plasma membrane? What is osmosis, membrane transport? Oh, and then we're going to talk about some electrical properties of cells, because all cells in your body, if they're alive, they act like little batteries, right? And then we're going to talk about how cells can signal each other so that they can act in a coordinated fashion. All right, so the extracellular environment actually is pretty similar to the intracellular environment, is because it's both mostly made out of water. Okay, it's sort of like a cup of coffee or tea. You take stuff and you dissolve it in that water, and that's what we call a solution. So our body is mostly made out of water. The intracellular compartment, right, everything inside, when we say intracellular, that's inside of a cell, that's 67% of your total body, okay, and that's water makes up 67% of what's inside of cells. Right, so you have the remaining part, things that are dissolved in there or things that precipitate out. Extracellular components, sometimes we just consider that ECF, that makes up 33%, or water, what an extracellular component, 33% is outside of cells. Okay. Well, I guess in terms of volume, right, in terms of volume, 67% is of the volume of your total body is outside, 33% is inside, inside and outside of a cell. So let's look at what's outside of the cell. What makes this 33% of your body? And we're going to see that 80% of this thing right here is what we call interstitial fluid. Interstitial fluid is fluid that is contained between cells, right? And most of that is water, interstitial fluid. And that water likes to stay in that area because of something maybe that we call ground substance, and it's a gel-like material, kind of acts like a sponge, and it absorbs water. Right? So the nice thing about having this water is that when things can move through water, they can move between cells very nicely, as opposed to maybe a solid. All right, things can't move through solid media very easily or not at all. But if it's a water environment, right, then things can move around between cells pretty easily because this ground substance is made up mostly of water. The other place that we find water is in a connective tissue as well, but that is in blood. And blood has a watery part or a fluid part and a cellular part. The cellular part we call formed elements. And the other part is what we call plasma. So plasma is the watery part. It's the non-cellular part of blood. All right, so that's the extracellular compartment, plasma and interstitial fluid. All right, so what do we have right here? We can see these different compartments. Here I have a nice blood vessel, right, and I see a cell. That's a red blood cell. That's part of the formed elements in blood. And then plasma is going to be over here, right, and that's some fluid outside of a cell. And then this blood vessel is being held in position by this connective tissue. Right? And I know that's connective tissue because I see a cell here, and I don't see a cell right next to it. Right? I see a cell way down over here. So that's a connective tissue because there's a big space between these cells. And if it's a connective tissue, this big space, anybody remember what this big space is called? It's called the matrix, right? This is a matrix in connective tissue. And in that matrix, it can have fibers, but it can also have that ground substance that we were talking about that holds onto water. And I maybe see some other fibers right here. Right, so these fibers are connecting this blood vessel with this layer that I see on the top, and then I don't see anything up over here. Right, that's just some free space, so we could maybe call this a free edge. Right, and what do we have that lines cavities or surfaces? So this might be a surface in your body. What do we have that lines a surface? What kind of tissue? Epithelium. Yeah, and you could probably characterize this epithelium very nicely by either by both the layers and the shape of these cells. How many layers do you see? There's just one. And that's called a simple, and the shape of these cells are cuboidal, so here's a simple cuboidal epithelium. Then I see a basement membrane that attaches it to this connective tissue. Connective tissue here connects it to muscles and bones and other things that are inside your body. All right, what else do I see? This cell is secreting these fibers into the matrix, so this is a fibroblast. Right. And I see things leaving this blood vessel. Right. And that means it's a special kind of blood vessel. There's only one kind of blood vessel where things can either enter or leave, and you know that to be a capillary. And because it has the right structure. The structure of a capillary is what? Just a simple squamous epithelium, but since it's keeping blood inside, or it will line every kind of blood vessel, we call it an endothelium, but it's really an epithelium, simple squamous. And you probably know a couple different kinds of capillaries by how leaky they are. Right? This one looks like a continuous capillary, it's not very leaky, but then you have fenestrated and sinusoidal capillaries that are really leaky, so you should maybe have a picture of that in your mind. All right, so these things are held together by these filaments, right? And the strong ones are collagen. And then there's some weaker ones that if you pull on collagen, it's not going to stretch because it's so strong. It's like a steel cable or a Kevlar cable. There are other kinds of filaments or fibers inside tissues that are made with elastic protein. And if you pull on those will stretch. Right? And then when you let go, what happens to them? This is their magic property. They go back to their original shape. Like, so you can stretch your skin and then let go, and it will go back to its original shape. Right, the stuff that holds water in this space right here, right, is what we call ground substance. And all of these things are connected together with proteins that are in the membrane that we call integrins. Integrins are proteins in the membranes of all these cells, and these filaments attach to them to just keep everything in place. Okay, and here we have interstitial fluid. And that interstitial fluid is dissolved in that jelly-like material and kind of acts like a sponge. And what it is a proteoglycan. Glycan is kind of a contraction for glucose. Proteo, it represents what kind of molecule that we've looked at so far? A protein. So here is a modified protein. It's been modified with a glucose. And you should know what kind of organelle inside the cell is responsible for doing such a thing. Okay, what is an organelle that's responsible for modifying proteins? Yeah, this from anatomy. So I'm reviewing anatomy just a little bit. That is a Golgi body, Golgi apparatus, right? Okay, Golgi is responsible for doing that. Or for making proteolipids, proteins that have a lipid molecule joined to them. All right, so we have a very watery environment. I think that's the whole purpose of that slide, is to show you we have a very watery environment, even though there's a lot of solid spaces in our body, because things can move across or move around in your body if it's in a fluid. And the fluid in our body is water. Okay. I might want to start using some of these terms. Probably familiar with them already, but let's write it out. We have a solution. Okay, a solution is a mixture of something. All right, so it's not like solving a problem, that kind of solution. All right, but it's a mixture of something. A solution has two components to it. Okay, and these two components are the solvent, right, and the solute. Both of these things could be liquids, right, in which case whatever has more liquid, whatever component is in more abundance, we call that the solvent. Whatever in less abundance, we would call the solute. That's one way to think about it. Another way of thinking about it is one could be a fluid, but the other could be a solid. But when you put that solid in this liquid over here, it's going to dissolve. That would be a solute. So, I don't know, did anybody use any solutes today? No? What did you have? Sugar. For instance, maybe you made some coffee or tea, and you put some sugar into that coffee, and that coffee, the solvent is water, the solute would be that sugar. And of course, all those little coffee particles would be solute as well. Okay? All right, so in our bodies, the solvent that we're mostly interested in is water. Very few places where you have a different solvent. And that would be a lipid solvent, an organic solvent, or even a lipid in particular. Okay, so when we think about things moving across the membrane, well, let me just write this down. Some examples. H2O, and let's just say glucose. Or I could say that. What is that? Okay, good. Okay, so those would be examples of solutes. So when we say transport across the plasma membrane, we could be talking about either the solvent or the solute. Right? It could be either one of those. And we know that the plasma membrane is selectively permeable. It can, because of the proteins that are in that membrane and the nature of the membrane, some things can move across it easily and other things can't pass through at all or only under certain circumstances. And so there might be a lot of important molecules that are trapped outside the cell, and the cell needs them, so there has to be special transport mechanisms or machines that can actually move these things from one side of the membrane to the other. And those are going to be proteins. So one way that something can move across the membrane is with a carrier-mediated transport system. So it involves a protein. And some things can move through a membrane without help. We're going to call that non-carrier mediated transport. So one of these things, it just so happens, requires energy. The carrier mediated transport needs energy. The non-carrier mediated transport does not require energy. Right? And one of the things that doesn't require energy is something that we call diffusion. Bless you. It's called diffusion. Okay. So on the previous slide, we talked about something that requires energy, something that does not require energy. There's a better way of talking about that. If it does not require energy, we call that passive transport. And if it requires energy, it is active transport. And you know the form of energy that's used almost everywhere in your body is, what's the form of energy? ATP. That's right. So if you ever see a diagram with something moving around and the question is this active or passive, what should your eye look for? An ATP molecule, right? If it's being used up, you know it's active transport. If you don't see any ATP, then it's a passive transport. So passive transport also means that compounds move down their concentration gradient. They go from high concentration to low. When it's active transport, it could go the other way around. So let's think of, yeah.
These are both carrier mediated?
Passive, they can be. Okay, they can be. It might get some obscure examples of passive transport that needs a carrier molecule. Okay, but usually passive transport, even passive transport needs some kind of mechanism to get through the cell membrane, unless it's a lipid. So it's a really complicated story. I'll need maybe a couple lectures to describe what's going on there. Okay, but that's a great question, though. Yeah?
Is phagocytosis like the way?
Phagocytosis is what we call macromolecular transport. So the cell actually forms a big dimple, and then the cell surrounds a big particle that has no chance of getting inside the cell, and then the cell completely surrounds it. And that piece then buds away from the membrane, and now that big particle is inside the cell. Okay, that's phagocytosis, and that definitely requires energy. And it requires nice microtubules inside the cell, and that requires energy. Yeah, so that's a form of transport, but macromolecular transport. And we're going to think about molecules and then that macromolecular stuff. Yeah.
Can active transport ever go with the gradient?
If it's going with the gradient, then there's no need to use energy in your cell. Okay, so typically it's kind of along those two lines. One or the other. Right. Okay. Okay. Passive transport. Yeah.
You said all facilitated
diffusion does not require energy. Okay. And we're going to talk about some of these things. But let's get the basic building blocks down here. Passive versus active transport. All right. So let's just say I have a perfume bottle right here. Okay, and there's a compound in there that likes to evaporate into the air very quickly. All right, so I take the cap off, that perfume evaporates into the air, and there's a pretty high concentration right around the bottle. But what about the concentration in the back of the room? What's it going to be? It's going to be zero, right? Unless somebody is up there with a perfume bottle exactly like this one. So high concentration here, zero up over there. And there's no fan blowing air around inside the room. And that perfume molecule is actually going to start to move, all right? And it's going to move. People in the first row will smell it first, then the second row, then the third row. And the movement of that perfume molecule from high concentration to low concentration is what we call diffusion. Doesn't require energy. All right, so that's going from high concentration to low. That's passive transport. And it's dependent on a concentration gradient. So what does that mean? That means that if I leave that perfume bottle open and we leave it sit here over the weekend, a lot of perfume is going to dissolve out of it or evaporate out of it, close the doors. And when we get here on Tuesday, open up the doors, what is the concentration of perfume going to be in this room? Okay, what about in the back row? High, and over here is going to be high as well. All right, so it's going to be uniform. There's no concentration gradient anymore. So can a passive transport mechanism be working if the concentration of that perfume is the same no matter where you look? You know what? Then there's no longer any kind of passive movement of that molecule. It's going to stop. It requires a gradient. If the gradient is zero, transport is zero. If the gradient is big, the transport can be fast. That's how it goes. All right. Active transport moves things from low concentration to high, okay, and it requires energy. So if we have this perfume bottle, okay, it is possible to take all those perfume molecules that are in the back of the room and stick them back into the bottle, but that's going to be going from low concentration to high. And obviously it's possible, otherwise you'd never have any perfume in here. But in order to get all those perfume molecules back in this bottle, what do you need? You need energy and some kind of mechanism to do that, right? It's going to require energy. So things can go in the reverse way, right? They can go against the concentration gradient, but it's an active process that requires energy, and in our body, that energy is ATP. Oh, here's what I wrote on the board. A solution has these two components right here. Good, you're familiar with these. So what have you used as a solvent today? Probably water. Probably nobody used gasoline as a solvent. People used to, but we lost a lot of people when they used that as a solvent, as an organic cleaner. Okay. What solutes have you used today? We said glucose, sugar, for instance, maybe coffee particles or tea particles would be the solutes. And in our body, what is the major solvent? What are we dissolved in? Water, right? Okay. And what are some important solutes in your body? Well, those are important too, right? Glucose, sodium, potassium, nucleic acids when they dissolve in water, monosaccharides, right? All of that kind of stuff. Amino acids, those are important solutes. All right, now here's sort of a tricky question. What is a minor solvent in your body? Okay, so we said water is the major one, but there's also a minor one. And its nature is completely opposite. The minor solvent, anybody have a guess? Okay, so it's not water. Lipids. That's right. We do have lipids in our bodies. Certain things can dissolve in those lipids, right, which can't dissolve in water. So that's a solvent system as well. Okay? The lipid part, like a phospholipid. we're going to see what a membrane really looks like, and the interior space of that membrane is just purely lipid. That's the lipid world inside our bodies, and that's a very small volume. All right, so what can dissolve in this minor solvent, which is lipid? What can dissolve in lipids? Anything that is nonpolar, like cholesterol, okay? Part of a fatty acid. Any of those lipid-like materials can dissolve in that lipid solvent. So, and I give an example. Cholesterol is a really good example, right? Because cholesterol is a lipid. So it's nonpolar, likes to be in this lipid part of our body. Okay, so the first passive mechanism that we're going to understand is something that we call diffusion. And if we take a molecule, like this molecule right here, it's really not sitting there. We would need to get a really powerful microscope, and you're going to see that this molecule is actually bouncing around all the time, just kind of in a microscopic way. And the only time it stops is when you're at absolute zero. Some people that have taken chemistry know how cold absolute zero is. Does anybody know how cold absolute zero is in terms of centigrade? Don't tell me in terms of Fahrenheit. It's minus, I like that, 273 degrees. That is super, super cold. I don't think we've ever been able to get to that temperature anywhere, right? And at that temperature, this molecule is going to stop moving. And as soon as the molecule warms up, it's going to start vibrating around. And as things warm up more, it's going to vibrate faster and faster and faster and faster, right? So the vibrational mode of this molecule moves with temperature. So all of these molecules are moving around because we're not at absolute zero, and they act like little stirring bars inside the solution. Right, so here we have a container, and we have high concentration of some kind of solute over here, low concentration over here, and diffusion means how is this molecule going to move from high concentration to low concentration? Because all these molecules are mixing around together all the time. That's just a property of temperature. All right, so these molecules will move to the right, and then after a long period of time, the concentration, is there a difference in concentration between these two areas of this beaker? No, they're the same. So what happens to diffusion? Because remember, diffusion can only go from high to low. There's no high or low over here, so diffusion stops. And as a matter of fact, as this concentration gradient gets larger, that means maybe this gets to be a higher concentration, then diffusion works faster. The rate of diffusion is related to the concentration gradient. So if there's just a little concentration gradient, like right before you get to this condition here, diffusion is very slow. If there's a large concentration gradient, like I see here, that diffusion is fast, and it's always going to go from high to low. Okay, I have kind of a nifty way to think about diffusion, but how are you guys doing on diffusion? Do you have a pretty good picture in your mind of what diffusion is? Okay. Would anybody like another illustration of what diffusion is? Yeah, okay. Well, I like to talk about this car that I had when I was in college. Okay. And it was an MGB. I don't know if any of you even know what an MGB is, but it's a European car, really, really small sports car. But it's really, really old when I had it, which means what? It needed a lot of maintenance all the time. Sometimes the battery was dead, sometimes the clutch wouldn't work, sometimes starter motor wouldn't work, all right? And so I would have a hard time starting this car, but since it was a sports car, it had a manual shift, so where would I park all the time with this car that I didn't know if I could start or not? I would park on top of a hill, right? So here we have a hill, all right? And here I have this really fancy MGB that I didn't even know if it would work when I got to it. I would park up here, and what would I do? I would give it a little push, right, and would it roll down the hill even with the engine off? Yeah, it sure would, right? And then I could use that energy as it starts rolling down the hill to pop the clutch. That would turn the engine over, it would start, and then I could go home. So that's really nice. And hopefully, and I lived on a hill when I was at home, so I could get to school. All right, so going from high to low, like that, does that require energy? Well, the car will automatically roll down the hill. Same thing for diffusion, right? From high to low, that just automatically happens. Now, what about going back up the hill? Will that car automatically roll up the hill? It will not. It needs energy, right? So when a process goes from low to high concentration, you need energy, and that energy in your body is ATP. All right, so that's kind of a fun thing to think about in terms of diffusion, huh?
How did I get back from school?
I'd have to park that on a hill. I'd have to find a hill, right. It was a really small car, so I didn't need a really big hill. I could almost, on a flat surface, I could almost get it started by myself. Okay. So I had a couple options. Okay. And as this gradient gets bigger, the car goes faster, right? If this hill is really small, the car doesn't go so fast. Same thing for diffusion. If the gradient is large, a lot of diffusion. Gradient small, very little diffusion. All right, so let's take a look at this slide. I see a couple cells over here and over here. And I see, and there is a watery environment that they're sitting in, right? And I see some solutes in this solution. And I think there's probably two different kinds. There's oxygen and carbon dioxide. And maybe I'll be able to figure out the color of these things in just a second. Oxygen and carbon dioxide are nonpolar compounds. But it just so happens that oxygen and carbon dioxide will dissolve in water. Oxygen, not so much, but carbon dioxide dissolves in water very easily, even though it's a nonpolar compound. But so if it's a nonpolar compound, where does it really like to be? Does it really like to be in water or a lipid? It really likes to be in a lipid, right? Okay, so here we have a cell, and over here we have a cell, and the membrane that surrounds the cell right here is a phospholipid. So this oxygen can diffuse right into the cell because it can move across that lipid barrier. So it can move into the cell. But how is it going to move into the cell? It's going to do it just passively, right? So we need oxygen to make ATP, and in that process we produce CO2, so that's a excretory product. We need to get rid of that from our body. So what kind of mechanisms can we use to move these molecules around? Well, in the air, there is high oxygen, and inside cells, there is low oxygen. So we don't have to do anything special to get oxygen inside our cells because it likes to go inside cells just because of that concentration gradient. Right? We need a vascular system and some lungs to deliver the oxygen around to this area, but it's just going to move into a cell all by itself. So that's a little strange. If I ask you, where is oxygen at a high concentration? And I would say, is it in the cell or is it in outside the cell? Well, you know cells need oxygen, so you might think, well, oxygen should be high inside the cell, but you know what? It's not. It's low. If it was high, which way would oxygen go? It would go from the cell out, and then the cell would not have oxygen, right? So oxygen is low inside the cell, and that draws, by diffusion, oxygen inside the cell. The cell's metabolism converts that oxygen into CO2, and so when it's doing that, now we have a high concentration of CO2 inside the cell, and it's almost zero outside the cell. In the room, CO2 is almost zero, right? And it's high inside the cell, so which way is carbon dioxide going to go? From high to low, almost zero in the air, so it zooms out of our body, no problem. So that's how things move from by diffusion. Okay, so here we have a phospholipid bilayer. That's a membrane, and we could think of this as being a cell membrane. Over here we have outside of the cell, extracellular fluid, and then here we have intracellular fluid and organelles. And if we put intracellular fluid and organelles together, what do we get? We get cytoplasm, right? So organelles and cytosol make cytoplasm. So here is a lipid region, very special lipid region. And what can be in this region right here? Can a polar compound be in this region? No, because it is a nonpolar region. So anything that is polar can't get through the cell membrane because it can't get through this layer right here, which includes water. And includes, well, I erased it over here, glucose, because it's a highly polar compound, sodium. Any kind of ion cannot get through this membrane, but it's going to be important that they do. So what the cell does, it makes a protein that can go across the membrane, and this protein can form a channel or a pore. If this channel remains open all the time, we just call it a pore. But a lot of these channels can open or close on instructions that are happening inside the cell or maybe even outside the cell.
All right, so now I see that this channel is open.
All right, so we got two states for that same protein, either closed or open. Here we have a high concentration of some kind of solute in the extracellular fluid and a low concentration inside the cell. So what does this solute like to do? Does it like to move into the cell or out of the cell? From high concentration to low, right? So it wants to go from outside to the inside of the cell. But without this protein here, can it? It's trapped outside, right? And even if this protein is in the membrane, if this channel is closed, it still can't go inside. But let's open up this channel, right? And now there is a passageway for this polar compound to move across the membrane from high concentration to low. And that's what we're going to call diffusion if this is a solute particle, right? Anytime something goes from high to low, that's diffusion, even through a membrane. All right, so a charged molecule must have an ion channel or a transporter. So give me an example of a really small charged molecule. Anybody think of a charged molecule? It's really small. Yeah, so I think I heard potassium, sodium, right? So any kind of ion is a charged little particle. So sodium, potassium can't get through a cell membrane unless it has what? An open channel. And same thing for calcium is an ion. Chloride is an ion. Any kind of electrically charged particle can't get through this cell membrane. And polar compounds can't get through the cell membrane. And one polar compound that we saw a lot of would be a monosaccharide because of all those hydroxyl groups on it. So sugar cannot get inside the cell, but sugar is an important energy molecule. So if you have high sugar on the outside of the cell, low sugar on the inside, it's dying to get in, but it can't unless it has help with some kind of protein that's in the membrane. Right, so without some way for glucose to get inside the cell, that cell is going to starve for glucose. And you kind of know what that condition is called already. That's called diabetes, right? Diabetes mellitus, right? Type 1, type 2. Glucose can't get inside the cell. It wants to. High concentration out here, low here, but it can't get through the cell membrane because glucose is polar. The membrane is nonpolar. All right, so there's something wrong with that transport mechanism. So the rate of diffusion, we talked about this a little bit, is the magnitude of the concentration gradient. And when the concentration disappears, what happens to diffusion? It stops. Yeah, it disappears too. All right? And if there's a membrane, it's going to be related to the permeability of the membrane to that particular substance. All right? So if we look at this membrane, polar compounds can't get across. So there's no diffusion, but nonpolar compounds can actually move through the membrane because there is that nonpolar region, right? So things that dissolve in oil move right through cell membranes, hardly obstructed at all, right? So if there's high concentration of a nonpolar compound here, low concentration here, that polar compound will move right in. Voltage is a difference in charge across the membrane. Okay, voltage usually is used to open or close these channels. Okay, so your question was really good, but state it once again. Oh, yeah, yeah. So the voltage, the charge across this membrane is going to change. We're going to look at that at the end of this chapter. The electrical charge is going to change on either side of the membrane, and depending on the change in charge, this protein here, there's a lot of proteins that will change conformation. They can either be closed or open depending on the voltage across the membrane. That's going to be an important class of channels. But we're going to get to that a little bit later in the chapter. Okay. Also temperature, because what happens with temperature? What moves with temperature? That motion, that molecular motion, right? The warmer the temperature, the more things are being mixed around, faster the rate of diffusion, right? And the other thing is, if you have a large surface area, diffusion is faster. Surface area, right, is just the doorway for exchange. So the bigger, the larger the surface area, the more things can move across. All right, and whenever I say surface area in this class, I want you to think of doorway. And let's talk about that right now. So how can I measure a surface area? Surface area would be like This tabletop right here, we can measure what the what this surface is. We can measure it in inches. So it would be square inches, the number of inches in this dimension, number of inches in this one, or we could measure it in feet or centimeters or whatever. And what I have right here is something in centimeters, right? And there's 100 of them right here. 100 centimeters is a meter, so this is a meter stick. Kind of looks like a yardstick, but it's not close. Okay. So when you think of surface area, let's go over here and measure the surface area of this door right here. How would I measure surface area of this door? I need a ruler, and I would measure the width. Oh, is that nice? It's exactly 1 meter. That's really, really nice. But we have to multiply that by how tall the door is. So how tall is this door? So it's 1 meter, and then it is, oh, it's exactly 2 meters. That's wonderful. Okay? So what's the surface area of that door? It's exactly 2 square meters. Well, we have that door, but garages also have a door that's big that allows a car to go through, right? So it's a big garage door. I don't know what the surface area that is, but y'all probably agree that it's larger. So I'll ask a question. How many people can get through that doorway at one time? Two easily, maybe three, four if they get a really good head start, right? They sprint through there. They might get stuck. Certainly they'll make a lot of noise going through, okay? Okay, so two or three. How many people can go through a garage door, car door at one time? Two, three? No, I don't know, 10, 20, 30, 40 maybe, 100 if they get a good running start. Okay, so as the size of the doorway increases, what can you tell me about transport through that doorway? It increases, right? So they're directly related to each other. So the larger the surface area, the rate of diffusion increases. It's directly related. Right? It's not inversely related. So diffusion doesn't go down it doesn't go down as the doorway gets bigger. Diffusion gets larger, gets faster when the doorway gets bigger. So whenever I say surface area, what should you think of in everyday language? Doorway. Think of it as a doorway. Okay? All right. But it does, there is something that slows down diffusion, and that is the size of the particle. The heavier the particle, the bigger the particle is, the slower it's going to move. It's going to take a little bit more of that vibration to get it around. And the way that we measure the size of something is what we call molecular weight. All right, so if molecular weight is really low, it's a small molecule. If there's a large molecular weight, that means it's a big molecule, and that's inversely related to diffusion. So as the molecule gets bigger, what happens to diffusion? It goes down because it's inversely related. We're going to think of a lot of things in this class as being directly related or inversely related. It's a really nice, easy way to think of some things. All right, so what are we done in here? 45? 12:45? Okay, when we come back, we might review diffusion a little bit and then start talking about osmosis. So you could read up on osmosis a little bit.